Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Today I'm joined by the writer Mark Mason, and as it's the first day of December, we're going to kickstart the festive feeling with a few non-fiction reads that he has enjoyed this season and may well be putting under the Christmas tree. Mark, welcome to the show. We're going to begin with The Word Detective by John Simpson, an academic who spent 37 years working on the Oxford English Dictionary. The book is a memoir looking back on those years and defending the role of the lexicographer. Mark, dictionaries themselves are not normally considered particularly interesting reads, so why would this memoir about writing one be interesting?
I think they can be interesting reads. I've always been a bit suspicious of them. I know what you mean. Kenneth Williams always learned four new words from the dictionary every day. And I've always thought that gets the dictionary wrong because you can only know the word in context. You know, okay, the dictionary is going to give you a very, very precise definition, but and it might give you examples. But it's always struck me as they're not... I know what you mean. They're not proper books in themselves. They're guides to the language. But actually, you know, it's the Oxford English Dictionary, obviously, being the huge dictionary. There's really fascinating stuff in here about how it came about. Some of the book is not just about his own work on the dictionary, but the historical stuff. The first volume was started or came out in 1884, and that covered A... to ant. They didn't even get to the end of the A's.
And was this Samuel Johnson, or was this
no.
He
did his own dictionary a couple of centuries before that, century before that. This one is late 1880s, but it's hard to give you a date. That was 1884. By 1903, they'd still only got to R. But then S was massive, and S took them into World War One, and they didn't actually finish it until 1928. And then there's some supplements that come along later in the 20th century. They planned one in 1957, but by 1972, they'd only done one of the four volumes of that supplement. So, you know, it's incredible work. And then the Compact came out, which was a two-volume version, and they sold that with a magnifying glass. Wow. Because the letters on the page were so small.
And I mean, obviously, 37 years. This working on a dictionary is not a kind of a speedy thing. I mean, I don't know how much he managed to achieve in those 37 years. But how does he make it interesting in this book? I mean, how does he keep those 37 years interesting?
Because a lot of it is going through the mechanics of what was happening and computerizing. And he was involved in the early computers. You know, when he started there, the computers did exist, but they weren't. Incidentally, one of the things he does to make it interesting is stop off at various points and highlight. Like various words and just the history of those words. One of which, I've just remembered having said computer, is computer itself. And computer, like the word typewriter, originally meant the person rather than the machine. Mm. So the typewriter was the person who was operating what we would now call the machine called the typewriter. And the computer was a person who sat there totalling up statistics and figures and doing the maths. So that's one of the things that he does. And also he talks about his own personal life. And one of the most powerful bits is at the end of the book, he talks about his younger daughter. He's got two daughters. The younger one was born in 1990. And they gradually realised that she had massive learning problems to the extent that she just doesn't speak at all and still never has. And they're really incredible bits. The irony of a man who spent his whole working life on the Oxford, nearly his whole life, on the Oxford English Dictionary and was obsessed with words, to have a daughter who couldn't speak. One of the passages he says, "She's happy in her own wordless world. I always thought I would be able to break in. I'm still trying to because she can't give up."
It's very powerful.
Absolutely. And then a few pages later he says, "Even if I can't communicate with her verbally, spending time with her reminds me that interaction isn't only verbal. Seeing her takes you into a corridor where communication fluctuates with the passage of time. When it's strong, it's the most important thing there is, wordless but powerful."
Wow.
And so that's the human side of it.
So there's kind of that kind of revelation going on alongside
which comes along quite late in the book. Well, obviously it would, because she was born later in his life.
So. I wanted to come on to this because the Oxford English Dictionary is obviously... It sort of pioneered this idea that actually dictionaries should be descriptive of language rather than prescriptive.
Yeah.
So the French are much more saying this is right and this is wrong.
Yes.
Whereas the Oxford English Dictionary has always been saying, you know, this is what language is really like and this is what language uses. Does he get into that kind of debate?
Yes.
Or is that?
Yes,
he does.
And I side with you, actually. I'm assuming from the way you painted it. Most people I know who love words and who love dictionaries, and even people who speak French and love French and spend a lot of time in France, and even some French people say it's ridiculous to try. You know, the French are always doing this thing of trying to ban words like le weekend and all that sort of stuff. And they try, keep meaning to try and dig out their replacement. They tried to ban the word email because for ages the French word for email was email. And they had this ridiculous 12-syllable replacement for it, which of course no one was going to use. So yes, in as much as I do have reservations about the dictionaries, as I said at the start, the English approach to it, where you come along behind the language and you document what's been happening, that is the way to do it. And it comes up with the fascinating stuff, the explanations for the various words that, like I say, he stops off in his own narrative once in a while. Juggernaut. I didn't know where the word juggernaut comes from. It comes from processions in India, where a huge ramshackle vehicle drew a massive model of Jagannath. Now, I'm sure I pronounced that incorrectly. I do apologise to any Hindus who are listening, but that's the Hindi name for Lord Vishnu. And so the big, massive vehicle that carried the Jagannath model became known in time as the juggernaut. That's where the word comes from.
Fascinating.
So it's you know, when he goes into details like that, it's a real document of how the language has developed and how it's a living thing, not the French approach of them trying to thinking they're breathing life into it. You know, the language does that itself. And he comes along and documents it.
The Word Detective by John Simpson is out now, published by Basic Books. Our next book celebrates 50 years of the Times Diary. This column in one of Britain's biggest national newspapers has been a main source of gossip and anecdotes for plenty of readers over the decades. And diarist and political sketch writer Patrick Kidd looks back on some of the tales it has told. Mark, first of all, I guess, give us a few anecdotes from these pages from this book. Which were your favourites?
That's a bit like saying give you the few of the best shots that Tiger Woods has ever played. Well, in his early part of his career. It's just packed with 50. Now, the Times Diary, I've always loved diary columns on newspapers. Because a lot of the news is very depressed, especially in a year like 2016, which has become the most depressing year on record.
Yeah.
The diary just picks up on stuff. And for instance, the diary this year broke the story of Boaty McBoatface. Now, for those, if you are the three people left on the planet who don't know about Boaty McBoatface, it was some scientific research vessel. And stupidly, the people in charge of giving a name to this new vessel decided to put an online poll.
Put it on Twitter.
That'll
be sensible.
And, yes, because as we know, it's a perfectly rational and sensible place, online media. And Boaty McBoatface was somebody's very facile suggestion, which absolutely smashed every other name out of the park in the poll. And so it's hard to... I thought that story was about 2 years ago, and then reading the book, I realised it was only this year. So that's the sort of story it does. And then that became a more famous one and made its way onto the news pages. But they do great little snippets that aren't worth a news story in themselves, or the boring people in charge of the rest of the paper would say that. And very often it's political. There was one from 2008, which refers back to 1990, when John Major had taken over from Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister. And Michael Portillo revealed this. Michael Portillo was then a frontbench minister under John Major. And so Thatcher, this incredible titan that had been Prime Minister for 11 years, was sitting on the back benches and in the House of Commons. And John Major leant across to Portillo and said, "How do you think the Prime Minister is coping with being on the back benches?" And Portillo had to say, "She's not the Prime Minister anymore, you are." Which, silly little story, but indicative of the mindset. Even the new Prime Minister had forgotten that there was a new Prime Minister. So there's stories like that. There are things like mistakes, misprints and things. They always crop up. And there was one, again, from this year. A printer in York had made some banners for a church in York. And he'd missed off the T, so it actually said that Chris is risen.
Very nice. So this column's been around for 50 years. I mean, how has it developed? And is that development kind of, does that become a bit of social history in a way? I mean, does it feel interesting kind of and strange looking back on, you know, what was interesting and relevant 40 years ago?
It's a very scary thought. Actually, just doing the maths now, that, you know, I was at university when Thatcher resigned and that Portillo Major story happened. And that's now nearer to the beginning of the 50 years than it is since, because it's 26 years since that happened. So it takes you back to big historical events like that. It also takes you back to pre-internet days. There's one from, where is it? I think it's the early, 1973, that was it. And there's a stage doorman at the Royal Opera House, which back then was opposite Bow Street Police Station, the building that was then still Bow Street Police Station. It's now being turned into a luxury hotel. But the stage doorman at the Opera House looked up and saw there was a policeman had come across. And the policeman says, "I have reason to believe that you can help me with my inquiries." So the doorman starts getting a bit nervous. And the policeman carries on, me and the other blokes in the nick are doing a crossword and we want to know Mozart's first name. So that takes you back to a time where, you know, these days they just look it up on their phones.
Right,
but
yeah,
back then, didn't exist. So there's stuff like that. There is, like I said, a boaty boatface. There's a million things. Sex always seems to feature.
Okay.
Nice little titillating stories.
And, I mean, what is the main role of the diary, do you think? Is it simply just to kind of divert people? Is it supposed to be fun and a bit, as you said, kind of, you know, in a serious newspaper, a bit of light relief?
Yeah.
Or is there a sort of more important function that it plays?
I think it's, like I say, the best ones, and I think this is true about a lot of things in life, what at first just seems a little joke. Like I say, with that John Major one, you know, he'd forgotten he was the Prime Minister. It's an insight, it's a little joke, and it doesn't matter, and governments aren't going to fall over it, but it's an insight into what's there. And there's a similar one of Question Time, the TV programme in Britain that's about, it's local politicians and important
program.
People, yeah, discussing the events of the week, with David Dimbleby, who is the chairman, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is a Tory MP and the son of William Rees-Mogg, who is editor of The Times and a very important figure in the establishment himself. J.P. Rees-Mogg talks about being at school, and Dimbleby leans across and says, oh, that was at Eton by any chance, the most expensive, the most exclusive public school there is. And Jacob Rees-Mogg says, yes, I was there with your son. And Dimbleby had very stupidly forgotten that he sent his own son to Eton and had tried to make a cheap point. So, yeah, again, very, you know, silly little story, but it shows mindsets and what people are forgetting some of the time.
The Times at 50 by Patrick Kidd is published by HarperCollins. Finally, Mark, we're going to delve into the history of one of London's biggest attractions, London Zoo, which opened in 1828, which incidentally makes it the world's oldest. The book is called The Zoo, The Wild and Wonderful Tale of the Founding of London Zoo, and it's by historian, writer and TV producer Isabel Charman. Mark, what did you like about this?
I like the way that it's personalised. The way that the book works is to take several figures who were important. Each chapter focuses on one person who was important in the history of the development of the zoo and tells it from their point of view. And it's told in the present sense. It's one of those slightly novelistic ways of telling history where it's all personalised. And she admits that she's invented certain scenes that she can't know happened, but that sort of fits with the general narrative. For instance, we start with Sir Stamford Raffles, who came back to Britain from the Far East, where he'd been with the East India Company. And he'd made a lot of money over there, and the company had made a lot of money over there. And he's back in London. And he's almost all of their children, all except one of their children, the couple's children, have died over there. And so he's sort of a broken man. And the one thing keeping him going is this dream of founding a zoo, because he had a collection of animals out there. And the couple, it talks about him and his wife sharing joyful memories of their children playing with the young tigers in the nursery. How they'd all traipsed through the aviary, dodging flapping wings and bullets of excrement.
Wow.
So that tells how he gets back and he starts trying to raise interest in it and raise money to do it. And then we go through and meet Decimus Burton. Sounds like a character from a Dickens novel, but yeah, it's his true name. And the reason that he was called Decimus was he was a 10th child. So he's the architect who starts designing it in Regent's Park, which is slightly out of what you would call the very centre of London, heading up towards the north of the city. And while they're designing and building the buildings there to house the animals, because they've already started collecting animals, and there were various private menageries around that time, they've got some animals from there and various other places. Some of the animals have to be housed at 33 Bruton Street, which coincidentally is a street a few decades later where the current Queen was born, bang in the middle of Mayfair, townhouse. Even back then, it was a developed area. So they're housing not giraffes or anything, but they're housing the little animals. And one day when Decimus Burton calls around there, a monkey steals his hat. So it's the nice colour about it, that sort of little personalised, humorous details, that it's not just a dry academic history and it becomes a success.
And does the author, Isabel Charman, I mean, does she take a view on whether zoos are ethical and whether the treatment of animals is fair? I mean, because, you know, in the 21st century, there are now sort of rallying cries to have them closed and that it isn't particularly fair. Does she take a viewpoint on
that? Not overtly. I mean, the way she tells the story And coincidentally, I was reading this at the time that London Zoo itself had a gorilla that escaped a few weeks ago. There was Kumbuka, his name was, and he escaped. So obviously lots of the animals aren't happy about being there. And I guess I'm sort of minded to think, by and large, I've always found them very depressing places when you go to zoos. Even the well-run ones, there's still this sense that these animals shouldn't be there. And I know the best ones now are run massively with the animals' welfare in mind. But if you start off from that point of view, I think this book is only going to reinforce it. Okay, we're talking nearly 200 years ago and things have improved since then. But still that serious purpose comes through. And it does, I think you end up, you're certainly on the side of the people who are trying to do it. They're doing it for the best of reasons. And you get the weird things that sort of mess with your head. You think that the exotic animals are the giraffes and the elephants and everything. You forget that Britain is just as strange to them as Africa or India or wherever they've come from would be to us. And they get four giraffes that are brought across and they're being walked from the docks in London where the ship that has brought them has docked at the docks there, and they're being walked through the streets of London up to Regent's Park where the zoo is. And they're so horrified by a cow that they see, because London was then developed, undeveloped enough for there still to be farms around. And these giraffes see a cow near the commercial road and they're so horrified by this cow that they won't move until the cow is taken out of view. So there are nice little stories like that. And it's a grim read at points, but fascinating social history.
The Zoo, the wild and wonderful tale of the founding of London Zoo by Isabel Charman, is out now, appropriately published by Penguin. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Mark Mason. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our film review. But for now, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.